Live from New York, it's the Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to learn about the sweet potato leaf as a great source of vitamins and minerals, how 100 million Americans live with chronic pain, but treatments are not helping them. I'll give you treatments that will. Four reasons to get rid of the dairy in your diet, and how they're trying to make ADHD a global or worldwide disease. That'll be interesting because Dr. Marilyn Wedge wrote an article in Psychology Today this week challenging that it's even a real condition. Good for her. Also, in the proceedings of the National Academy of Science showed the people who began learning English around age 10 and were immersed in the language, meaning they heard and used it in daily life, showed improvements in the structure of their brain's white matter compared to people who grew up speaking only English and did not learn a second language. So, learning a second language can boost brain power. We have a lot on health and healing, as we do every day. And then we're going to take a look at some issues in the environment, including how YouTube and Bono partner with Monsanto to bio-wreck African farms with GMOs. Also, new information we'll be sharing today on GMOs, and it's not good. But we also have a pro-former GMO scientist speaking out on the real dangers of genetically engineered foods. Therry Vrain from GMO Empowerment will be sharing that with us. And then, from our environmental segment, offshore wind blows drilling out of the water, a new report from Common Dreams. GMO in soy and maize, well, it's toxic to rats, that's according to a new study. And also, they were a little off on how much radiation was released from Fukushima. This is according to ENE News, which is a highly respected news service out of and reporting on Tokyo Institute of Technology and the University of California, San Diego, and another university in Japan. Quote, Fukushima released 13 million times more neutrons than initially estimated. Quote, obvious implication for human health. Neutron radiation is the most severe and dangerous radiation known to mankind and can travel great distances, end quote. It's one thing to be off by a measure of one or two. They're off a measure of 13 million. That means 13 million times. Wow. My guest in the second part of our program is one of only a handful of uncompromised politicians, Representative Alan Grayson. He's a member of the House of Representatives. He's going to give us an insight into the new Congress and a look at the big challenges facing the nation, foreign policy, defense, and energy. Needless to say, we'll be asking him the hard questions. We have a lot to share. Let's begin. Now, sweet potatoes are very good. Sweet potatoes and yams are in the same family. They're different, but they're both very rich in beta-carotene and also vitamin C. But Louisiana State University, and they love their sweet potatoes because they use it as a sauce and a thickener down there. It's a lot of gumbos. If you've ever been to New Orleans, if you've never been to New Orleans, I definitely recommend New Orleans and the French Quarter. Well, this study from that Louisiana State University showed that sweet potatoes are a very good source of a whole spectrum of nutrition, and we should be consuming them. Sweet potato soup, I guess, is how most Americans would consume them. But now they're finding that it's more than just the sweet potato there's also the entire sweet potato plant, including the leaves, are very rich in vitamin C. In fact, significant levels of vitamin B6 and other water-soluble vitamins. So, for those who are using holistic farming methods, just like using beet greens and carrot tops for vitamin K, now you'll be able to find an edible use of the sweet potato. We have a minimum of 100 million Americans living with chronic pain. Most are adults. That would put it over one-third of the population of adults. According to Indiana University, a new report shows, we've got a lot of people in pain, and we don't have a lot of good outcome in helping them. Well, how do we deal with pain in the United States? More often than not, we try to turn off the symptoms. Okay, well, you could certainly understand if someone's in excruciating pain, like pancreatic pain, that if there was no other therapy they were going to use, and they were only using orthodox therapy and chemotherapy, which itself creates pain, and radiation, which creates pain, then morphine would be the normal medication. In fact, most of the people going into hospice care who have pain are given morphine. Here's the downside of that. Morphine will help kill the pain. It also creates a state of cognition that a person is literally unable to have a conversation, to frequently recognize you, and if they do recognize you, not to be able to communicate. So shouldn't we be using other non-toxic natural techniques where you actually reduce the underlying cause of the pain? You're not just disguising it, the symptoms. And since I've written on the subject and produced a documentary on the subject, I just wanted to go through different ones. And these are some of the therapies that you could look at that would help you. So there's a whole lot of different therapies. Of course, there's homeopathic medicines for pain. Homeopathy was created by Samuel Hahnemann, a German physician. And the basic principle of homeopathy is that the natural state of the human body is one of health and that we possess the natural ability to heal ourselves. What we describe as symptoms are actually the body's efforts to protect itself against disease. Therefore, to effect a cure, we should not suppress the symptom, but seek to stimulate the body's natural healing process. Conventional medicine does not do that. And as a result, it actually suppresses our natural healing ability and gives us a massive amount of toxic chemicals in our body in the process. So, homeopathic solutions have been known for a long time to help with pain. And you really should see a homeopathic physician. And homeopathics, most of them, about 80%, are derived from plants. And wild hops, marigold, poison ivy, honeybee, sodium chloride, flint, those are the ones that are normally used for pain. That's one. Another is heat and cold. You want to reduce swelling, which can then help reduce pain, especially in muscles, tendons, ligaments, over workouts, too strenuous, or something pulled. So you want the body to be able to flush the toxins and the uric acid out of the area. And if it's swollen, everything stays in place, including uric acid, and that creates additional pain. So cold and heat. Hydrotherapy, the therapeutic use of water or steam or ice, very effective. And like full baths, like an Epsom salts bath is very good, or a sitz bath, or a steam bath, whirlpools. These are all beneficial. Then also hyperbaric oxygen therapy. All human tissue and organs need oxygen. Hyperbaric oxygen is the administration of oxygen at a high atmospheric pressure. This saturates the body with oxygen, increasing the total available amount. And hyperbaric oxygen therapy would be my number one suggestion for a stroke because it can help stop additional damage. Even if you've had a stroke for 4 or 5 years, and you get hyperbaric, and that late, you can still help the tissue in the brain. And you generally just sit in a chamber comfortably, and you have pure oxygen at 3 times the normal atmospheric pressure, and the entire chamber is pressurized for treatment and then depressurized before the person is removed. And so that's very good also. It's good for people with trauma, burns, wounds, injuries from motor vehicle accidents, carbon monoxide poisoning, acute cyanide poisoning, smoke inhalation, and the death of tissues from radiation therapy. And hyperbaric oxygen therapy is also used to treat skin grafts that are failing to take and gangrene and decompression sickness and certain cases of blood loss and anemia. And when used after surgery, hyperbaric has been shown to greatly improve early healing in the majority of cases. So all of that would benefit the person who understands it. Juicing, of course, is great for pains. Fruits and vegetables, with all the phytochemicals they have, they can combat cancer and cancer pain. So, and there are enough books and videos around to see which juices would be good. But you want high levels of raw juices because you want that vitamin C. And that really, the more alkaline you can get the body, the less pain. The more acidic the body from proteins, the more pain. Green juices are particularly good for turning off pain. And potassium is also good. In fact, a potassium potato juice, cabbage juice for ulcers, pain in the stomach and the abdomen, and raw cabbage juice 3 times a day with a little cinnamon powder, fennel powder, and anise powder will make a difference. And even kiwi is good. And pain is the message from the body to the brain, signaling that disease or injury or activity has caused trouble in a given area. We need pain because without pain, how will we know that we've torn a ligament or we have appendicitis or that we have, you know, hurt ourselves? But you want to turn it off and heal. Acupuncture helps. Acupressure helps. By the way, acupressure and acupuncture are virtually based upon the same principles, the underlying foundation of contact healing. And it's one of the oldest healing techniques known. It's acupressure and the healing art of shiatsu, a massage technique, are commonly referred to as acupuncture without needles, where you have a point on the body that has to be stimulated and allowed to allow the chi, C-H-I, the life energy that flows through the body and along a pathway called the meridians. And people who are experienced in understanding where these energy lines are can open up, and suddenly you no longer have the pain in the leg or the back or the lower back. And acupuncture works off the same stimulation of vital life energy that flows through the living being, except they're using a needle. Then you have biofeedback, which is good for pain. You have breathing exercises, deep breathing exercises, chiropractic adjustment, guided imagery. You have herbs. I always look at herbs as an important part of the healing process. Angelica, black haw, H-A-W, cramp bark, kava, rosemary, valerian root. Those are good for cramps and muscle spasms, especially in a woman who's having PMS. A tea made of blue violet, catnip, chamomile, and gota cola, rosemary, and white willow, or wibetany, is effective in relieving tension and nerve pain. So we have to look at nature. Nature has all these wonderful things. Hypnotherapy, magnet therapy. Magnets are great for pain. Sleeping on magnets is good. Massage is terrific. I'm not big on deep tissue massage because unless someone's really knowledgeable, you can actually injure. But I am big on the Feldenkrais method and neuromuscular massage, reflexology, Reiki, and shiatsu, not Rolfing, and Swedish massage. Meditation works, Qigong works. And Qigong, Qi, Q-I, G-O-N-G, but it's pronounced Qi, C-H-I-E, is a slow motion exercise, and it's older than Tai Chi. It's based upon movement and breathing meditation. The Qi in Qigong is life force, and Gong, G-O-N-G, means work, a skill of practice. The Qigong increases vital energy for emotional and physical health. And Tai Chi, the TENS unit therapy for headaches, muscle aches. So we needn't feel that all we have at our disposal is, let's say, a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory like aspirin or ibuprofen. Thousands upon tens of thousands die each year from using non-steroidal anti-inflammatories because you get bleeding. If someone came to me who was going to have surgery and said, what should I have post-surgery to help me recover? I would recommend acidophilus 3 times a day, coenzyme Q10 3 times a day, coconut oil, the branched chain amino acids, garlic, cysteine, lysine, MSM, vitamin C at very high doses, but not while they're recuperating because you don't want the blood so it can't clot. Vitamin E is very important, generally at 200 units a day. And also vitamin E oil on the stitches with Manuka honey. The oil, then this, you spray colloidal silver, then you put on the vitamin E oil, and then you put the Manuka honey. Promotes healing and reduces scar formation. Vitamin K, it's important, needed for blood clots. And then zinc. And then the herbs would be dandelion and nettle. I would also recommend bromelain and turmeric and burdock root and red clover and echinacea. So with all the people out there and with all the pain we have, there's no reason that we can't find natural and non-toxic ways of dealing with it. And finally, for those who, well, they don't have a good enough reason to give up dairy. So let me share 4 reasons. First, acidity. You are much better off without dairy to maintain a slightly alkaline pH in the body between 7.3 and 7.4. Dairy is acidic and it ranges between 4 and 6.8. That is not good. So every time you have dairy, you put yourself in an inflammatory state. And that only feeds the damage in the brain, leading to dementia, memory loss, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, in the joints and in the heart, pancreas, diabetes. You also want to understand that dairy is high in cholesterol and saturated fats. That's linked to heart disease and diabetes. So you can get non-dairy alternatives. And it's loaded with toxins. Dairy naturally contains hormones produced by the cow's body. Now think of all the synthetic hormones that are given to cows. And do you really want that? I don't think so. And remember, humans don't need milk outside of breastfeeding in order to mature and have strong bones and strong immune systems. And why we drink milk from another animal, because you could drink the milk from a pig. You could drink the milk from a cat or the milk from a dog. They're lactating. That milk is meant for their puppies. The cow's milk is meant for the calf, the little heifer, and not for humans. They're not biologically identical. The growth rate of a baby into a toddler and the growth rate of a little baby calf into a cow are radically different. So keep those things in mind, and hopefully you'll be able to wean yourself off of that. Now to our environmental segment. I mentioned that they had made a mistake, and this is from scientist from Tokyo Institute of Technology, University of California, San Diego. And this was released in ENE News. Quote, Fukushima released 13 million times more neutrons than initially estimated. That's really bad because that's neutrons, and neutron radiation is the most severe and dangerous radiation. And they just finished this, and they just did this analysis, so what's the problem? All right, well, the problem is that this is far worse than what anyone had anticipated, that this gets in the air and travels, and this gets in the water and travels, and you can't clean it up. There's no way of getting rid of this stuff. It's going to be around a long time. So when we see millions of dead fish and hundreds of thousands of dead sea mammals, even dead birds, seabirds, this could be one of the reasons why. I think it's time that we stop pretending that the problem is going to fix itself through some technology that they're using over in Japan. It's not going to happen. It's just one giant mess. All it takes now is just one earthquake or one tsunami to bring down a little building that holds over 1,300 spent fuel rods, and that will cause a major hydrogen explosion that will dwarf any that we've ever seen, including Chernobyl, by substantial magnitude. We should bring together the world's greatest scientists. We should encase this and to help prevent it from happening. One more reason not to eat anything genetically engineered. This is from GM Watch, quote, a diet containing GM soy and maize fed to rats for 30, 60, 90 days caused a wide range of toxic effects, including DNA damage, abnormal sperm, blood changes, and damage to the liver, kidney, and testes. The team of researchers concluded that, quote, there are health hazards linked to the ingestion of diets containing genetically modified components. End quote. Histological examinations of various body tissues were carried out, and marked differences in the tissues of the GM-fed animals were found. So, one more reason. So when you have the apologists coming forward from the GM industry saying, there's no proof, yes there is. We now have over 47 different studies done by independent scientists. For those wondering what is better, because I keep hearing, well, wind is not that much better, and we should stick with fossil fuels because we know we have that material. We'll just figure out a way to make it cleaner, and hence the concept of clean coal. Well, you can't make clean coal. That's an oxymoron. But you can have a lot more wind, especially if it's oceaned, like in Scotland. This is the latest on this in Common Dreams. Quote, while the oil and gas industry continues to push for expanded drilling operations off the Atlantic coast and receive government subsidies for it, a new report by an ocean conservation group finds that the benefits produced by wind energy eclipse those of fossil fuels with far fewer risks. Many of the benefits touted by oil and gas companies do not hold up under scrutiny, according to Oceana Report. Offshore energy by the numbers and economic analysis of offshore drilling and wind energy in the Atlantic. That's the title of the article. The industry often inflates its job creation figures by including inaccessible resources in their calculations. But when they looked at everything, they found that it was wind that won hands down. So that's important. Also, want to share something with you from a former top person who was a pro-GMO scientist, someone from the inside coming outside to give us perspective. Quote, I retired 10 years ago after a long career as a research scientist for Agriculture Canada. When I was on the payroll, I was the designated scientist of my institute to address public groups and reassure them that genetically engineered crops and foods were safe. There is, however, a growing body of scientific research done mostly in Europe, Russia, and other countries showing that diets containing engineered corn or soya cause serious health problems in laboratory mice and rats. I don't know if I was passionate about it, but I was knowledgeable. I defended the side of technological advance, of science and progress. In the last 10 years, I've changed my position. I started paying attention to the flow of published studies coming from Europe, some from prestigious labs and published in prestigious scientific journals that question the impact and safety of engineered foods. I refute the claims of the biotechnology companies that their engineered crops yield more, that they require less pesticide application, that they have no impact on the environment, and of course that they are safe to eat. There are a number of scientific studies that have been done for Monsanto by universities in the United States and Canada and abroad. Most of these studies are concerned with the field performance of the engineered crops, and of course they find GMOs safe for the environment and therefore safe to eat. Individuals should be encouraged to make these decisions on food safety based on scientific evidence and personal choice, not on emotion or the personal opinions of others. We should all take these studies seriously and demand that government agencies replicate them rather than rely on the studies paid for by the biotech companies. The BT corn and soy plants that are now everywhere in our environment are registered as insecticides. But are these insecticidal plants regulated and have their proteins been tested for safety? Not by the federal department in charge of food safety, not in Canada, and not in the United States. There are no long-term feeding studies performed in these countries to demonstrate the claims that engineered corn and soy are safe. All we have are scientific studies out of Europe and Russia showing that rats fed engineered foods die prematurely. These studies show that proteins produced by engineered plants are different than what they should be. Inserting a gene in a genome using this technology can and does result in damaged proteins. The scientific literature is full of studies showing that engineered corn and soy contain toxic or allergenic proteins. Genetic engineering is 40 years old. It is based upon a naive understanding of the genome based upon one gene. One protein hypothesis of 70 years ago, that each gene codes for a single protein. The Human Genome Project, completed in 2002, showed that this hypothesis is wrong. The whole paradigm of the genetic engineering technology is based upon a misunderstanding. Every scientist now learns that any gene can give more than one protein, and that inserting a gene anywhere in a plant eventually creates rogue proteins. Some of these proteins are obviously allergenic or toxic. I have drafted a reply to Paul Horgan's letter to the Comex Valley Environmental Council. It is my wish that it goes viral as to educate as many people as possible rapidly. Any and all social media is fine by me. And then goes on to show in this letter about what's wrong. Quote, I'll just give you one sentence of it. I'm turning you towards a recent compilation of over 500 government reports and scientific articles published in peer-reviewed journals, some of them with the highest recognition in the world, like The Lancet in the medical field, or Advances in Food and Nutrition Research and Biotechnology, or Scandinavian Journal of Immunology, or European Journal of Histochemistry, or the Journal of Protein Research. This compilation was made by a genetic engineer in London and an investigative journalist who summarized the gist of the publications for the lay public. And this is about the GMO myths and the truths. An evidence-based examination of the claims made for the safety and efficacy of genetically modified crops. It's 112 pages. And then it shows that GMOs have never been proven safe. So that's from one former top person in the field of GMOs coming forward and telling the truth. So we appreciate his honesty. On the other end, we have people like Bono, who is using his celebrity power to partner with Monsanto to bio-wreck African farms with GMOs. This is from Food Free Group Randy Ananda. Quote, at the G8 summit held 2 weeks ago at Camp David, President Obama met with private industry and African heads of state to launch the new Alliance for Food Safety, Security, and Nutrition, a euphemism for monocultured, genetically modified crops and toxic agrochemicals aimed at making poor farmers debt slaves to corporations while destroying the ecosystem for profit. And Bono of the rock group U2 is out shilling for Monsanto on this one. It's phase two of the Green Revolution. Tanzania, Ghana, Ethiopia are the first to fall for the deception, with Mozambique and Faso and other African nations lining up for the new Grow Africa partnership under Obama's Good Global Agricultural Development Plan. And Obama pitches India model of GMO genocide to Africa. Scott Crichton writes, quote, "But African civil society wants no part of this latest Monsanto-aligned public-private partnership. Will the progressives do now that their flawless hero has teamed up with their most hated nemesis to exploit an entire continent like they did to India that not long ago? With a commitment of $3 billion, Obama plans to partner up with mega multinationals like Monsanto, Diageo, DuPont, Cargill, Vodafone, Walmart, PepsiCo, Prudential, Syngenta International, and Swiss Re, because as one USAID representative said, quote, there are things that only companies can do, like building silos for storage and developing seeds and fertilizers. Of course, that's an outrageous lie. Private citizens have been building their own silos for centuries. And it's true that only the BIREC engineers will foist patented seeds and toxic chemicals on Africa. Quote, Bono says that there has to be public-private partnership in order to get this done, and that they are going to be using the ideas of the African people and farmers. Really? This is what the African farmers say. We request that, quote, governments and G8, the World Bank, and other groups reconsider their promotion of public-private partnerships, which, as they are now conceived, are not suitable instruments to support the family farms, which are the basis of African food security and sovereignty. That was from the African Civil Society Organization. Quote, I wonder if that could be any clearer. They don't want the public-private partnerships involved in this process. It's not enough that huge megacorporations are bleeding the nations of Africa dry by sucking the valuable mineral resources out of their hills. No, as Bono says about the development in Africa, quote, they're future consumers for the United States. The president's talking business. This is good. It's a whole new development paradigm today. The old donor-recipient relationship is over, end quote. And that's Bono. Really, Bono? Better stick to writing Broadway plays. Forgot that crashed. We're writing music. That was successful. Because you sure don't have a knowledge of what's going on the ground in Africa. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment to talk with our guests. Please stay with us. Welcome, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. We're waiting on our guest. He has to call us, and when he does, we'll put him on. But we have a lot to share, including two more segments on the environment. This is important. This is from City College of New York. Quote, Greenland meltwater contributes to rising sea levels. As the largest single chunk of melting snow and ice in the world, the massive ice sheet that covers about 80% of the Greenland is recognized as the biggest potential contributor to rising sea levels due to glacial meltwater. Until now, however, scientists' attention was mostly focused on the ice sheet's aquamarine lakes, bodies of meltwater that tend to abruptly drain, and on monster chunks of ice that slide into the ocean to become icebergs. But a new study involving City College of New York scientist Marco Tedesco and the UCLA team reveal a vast network of little-understood rivers and streams flowing on top of the ice sheet that could be responsible for at least as much, if not more, sea level rise as the other two sources combined. Quote, it's the world's biggest water park with magnificent, beautiful, but deadly rushing blue rivers cutting canyons into the ice, said the study's lead author from the UCLA's geography department. The group also specifically examined one of the most famous rivers, which exits the ice sheet on land and drains for about one-fifth of the map network. Its output is critical because it's a key element of the atmospheric regional markings, meaning how much water is going from Iceland into the ocean. And it's just huge. So what they're showing here is, and this was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. So what this tells us is this. Well, some people in the United States, some in Congress, some in the media, are denying that global warming exists or denying that it's significant. The National Proceedings of the National Academy of Science just released a report from UCLA and the City College of New York showing Greenland's meltwater is contributing to rising sea levels, and that's due to global warming. So the science is there. Too bad they're not paying attention. And finally, I was just told our guest is on hold. This short piece, and this is from Common Dreams, Deidre Fulton, quote, losing the climate fight has 400 parts per million become the planet's new normal. Just 2 weeks into 2015, experts are expressing surprise and worry that the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has already topped 400 parts per million threshold several times, a troubling indication for the year ahead and an expression of humanity's continued failure to act on climate change. Quote, the new year has only just begun, but we've already recorded our first days with average carbon dioxide levels above 400 parts per million, potentially leading to many months in a row above this threshold. And that's according to Climate Central. And so that is not good. And yet, what has been done? How about next to nothing, mandating what we have to do? I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you all with us. Let's now go to our guest who's standing by, Representative Alan Grayson. Now, Representative Grayson is a member of the House of Representatives from Florida's 9th Congressional District. He is one of the few remaining authentic progressive voices in Congress. He's been in Congress fighting on behalf of the public, for example, the private contractor fraud in Iraq. He challenges the Federal Reserve. He is also an outspoken supporter for the public Medicare program for all citizens. And he has put a lot of pressure right now on seeing that something representing the public interest, gets into the public's consciousness. But he's up against some really strong opposition. He has degrees from Harvard University and Harvard Law School and John F. Kennedy School of Government. His website is grayson.house.gov. Nice to have you with us again.
Thank you. I looked over the transcript from last time I interviewed you, and I have to say both of us sounded really good.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you return to this program. Before asking you some specific questions about recent foreign policy and defense and energy issues, The 114th Congress just commenced, and not since 1931 have the Republicans held such a large majority of seats in the Congress. I believe most are, or possibly even all, are white Christians. How worried are you about the barrage of bills that will be coming your way from a regressive Republican Congress that wants to further increase the power and influence of big energy in the military and intelligence industrial complexes, wants to lessen the divide between church and state, wants to further widen America's inequality gap by cutting government assistance to those at the bottom of the social ladder, which already stands as the largest in the developed world, and Congress will certainly favor banks and the large mega corporations, likely with massive government bailouts, in the event of another deep financial crisis meltdown. Could you start there and address these, please?
Sure. I recently pointed out, I'm not the only one who noticed this, that for a five-month period that ended just 2 weeks ago, every single Republican member of Congress in both the House and the Senate, elected to both the House and the Senate, was white and a self-identified Christian. Now, that's interesting because among Americans as a whole, we have 27% who are African-American, mixed race, or Asian. We have 24% who don't identify themselves as Christians. And yet, of the 250-plus members of the House and Senate who were Republicans and elected to the House and Senate, every single one of them was a self-identified white Christian. And you can compare that to the Democrats. We have 27 Jewish Democrats. We have 2 Muslim Democrats. We have 2 Buddhist Democrats. We have 1 Hindu Democrat. You can compare that among the African Americans. We have 43 elected African American Democrats in our caucus. So we're a diverse group that actually represents and looks like America these days. And the Republicans are an unusually homogeneous group with a homogeneous and somewhat slanted platform. I don't think I can fault anybody for being part of that ethnic group, but I can fault them for taking positions that are skewed in favor of discrimination. So, for instance, the Republicans are against immigration reform. They're against affirmative action. They're in favor of voter suppression of minorities. They're adamantly against abortion in any circumstance, and they're even against marriage equality. So what you see is a homogeneous group that does not actually represent America, even though we are called representatives, having an agenda that is completely different and in many cases adverse to the people who are not part of their group.
I appreciate that opening statement. Last month, the Senate passed Congress's version of the National Defense Authorization Act, which pretty much continues funding the U.S.'s course of military operations overseas and cuts primarily military personnel pay and servicemen's health care and other allowances. It does provide over $5 billion for operations against ISIS, which emerged out of the ruins of Iraq and the U.S.'s own making. And there's $18 billion going towards our return to the past world of nuclear proliferation for renewed nuclear weapons development, evidently with Russia in mind, since the budget plan further isolates Russia while favoring the Ukraine and the regressive puppet government the U.S. has very likely installed there. So I'd like you to tell us your opinion about the latest defense budget. What are your greatest concerns over it? And do you feel this is the kind of militarist course and foreign policy the U.S. should be undertaking now? And second, since you were one of only 10 congressmen who voted against a resolution to condemn Putin and Russia for what the resolution claims is Russia's aggression towards neighboring countries, how worried should we be about the U.S. and our allies' aggressive posturing leading to a new Cold War with Russia?
I think we do need to be concerned. The military-industrial complex is constantly throwing up new enemies for us to try to attack, ISIS being the latest of them. But we don't attack them in the way that Colin Powell would have said to attack them. Instead, we attack them piecemeal with drones and occasional bombing runs and the like, without any real hope or even a plan for defeating them. And it seems almost random, except the one continuing thread to it all is the fact we spend $500 billion each year on the military. And that's exactly the way the military-industrial complex wants it. It's basically a shakedown. I don't think any rational person can conclude that we actually need to be spending $500 billion a year to defend ourselves from foreign governments, foreign armies, or even terrorists. In fact, what's happened is that we end up wasting enormous amounts of money in the guise of doing so. The fact is that I took an oath to show my respect for the Constitution and to uphold the Constitution. We all did just 2 weeks ago. And the fact is that if you look back and read the Constitution, you'll see that the Constitution does not even envision a standing army, much less an army standing in Kabul. Now, things have changed. Since World War I, we have had a standing army, even though there's no basis for that in the Constitution. The world moves on. But what we do is, rather than saying we might be invaded by Nazi Germany or we might be invaded by the Soviet Union, since those threats are clearly gone, instead we conjure threats that somehow are meant to justify a 6-million-man bureaucracy that we've created called our national defense that consumes consistently 5% of all the goods and services produced by this country year after year after year, much of which goes to military contractors. Military contractors, by the way, get more taxpayer dollars than all other government contractors combined, which probably surprises no one when you see the mammoth size of these contracts, $10 billion, $20 billion, $30 billion. And for what? Does anybody seriously believe that we need that in order to defend ourselves as a nation? Or even that it's effective in defending ourselves against lone terrorists or groups like ISIS that aren't even close to our shores? It's a racket. I'm not the first person to observe this, but it's a racket. And what it's done over time is it's impoverished the entire nation. We look at other countries with either smaller military establishments or, in some cases, close to no military establishment. And these countries see economic growth of 3 or 4 or 5% a year. We see a country like ours with a towering military establishment that ends up choking economic growth, and we end up with growth in a good year of 1 or 2%.
Since you sit on the Energy Subcommittee, and you're obviously privy to information that the major media won't cover regarding the XL pipeline, which you oppose, and we commend you for that, with the new GOP Congress, it seems certain this will be rammed through with only Obama's veto standing in the way. But what Americans don't realize, and almost no one is talking about, is who does the pipeline ultimately benefit? And you've stated it is China. And we know, of course, the Koch brothers are part of this whole process. So how can we justify something that is going to be going to Texas, from their process and shipped to China, the money from that goes back to Canada. So unless I miss something, we, the American people, are putting our environmental resources, including aquifers and rivers, water supplies and our land, at risk, and we're not the ones benefiting from this. Could you give us more details on this, please?
Sure. Just to give some background, what you're referring to is this concept that we will act as the conduit for dirty Canadian tar sands to be made into a slurry and sent through a pipeline across the United States to the Texas coast, at which point it will be refined, turned into actual usable products like gasoline and so on, and then shipped to China for the most part. China will be by far the biggest recipient of that resource. It's the dirtiest source of oil on the planet. It takes enormous amounts of water and energy. It consumes energy just to pull it out of the ground and turn it into some transportable form. Interestingly enough, the Canadians are smart enough to realize they don't want that going over their land, even though it starts in their land in Alberta. So they said, no, you're not going to have a pipeline across eastern Canada or western Canada. And they've turned to us, Uncle Sam being Uncle Sucker, they've turned to us to try to get it transported essentially in a line parallel to the Mississippi. It would cross almost 2,000 miles of American territory. It has not been licensed. To add insult to injury, existing law, which the Republicans have steadfastly defended, indicates that it will be transported without any taxation. So every other country in the world, and for instance, the Ukraine, that has any sort of gas or oil pipeline crossing it, exacts a tax for the benefit of its own people to have that, and also to ensure against the cost of environmental damage. And in this case, it will be transported across the United States tax-free. And in fact, Democrats offered an amendment to simply have it be taxed like every other pipeline. And the Republicans refused to allow that amendment to even come to the floor for a vote. So what we're doing is we are, in fact, putting our natural resources at risk for the benefit of, and this is from the CEO of the company that owns this pipeline, 50 jobs. We're talking about creating 50 permanent jobs, according to the CEO of the pipeline company. And for that sake, we're running the risk of destroying the Ogallala Aquifer, which 4 million people rely upon for the drinking water, and also represents the water supply for over 10% of all the farmland in the United States. So we're putting 10% of our food supply at risk for the sake of a pipeline that will not generate a dollar or even a penny in taxes, and will create a total of 50 jobs. And the reason why we're doing this is because, first of all, the Chinese want it, and the Chinese now hold $1 trillion of U.S. government debt. And secondly, and this is really the important point, the Koch brothers want it. The Koch brothers are by far the largest beneficiaries of the Republican Party. They spend $100 million in every single election to benefit only Republican candidates. I can't think of a single Democratic candidate they've ever supported. And the Koch brothers are the largest influence on Republican policy known to mankind. And the Koch brothers also own more than half of the refining capacity on the Texas coast. So when that slurry comes through that pipeline, it will be going to a Koch brothers refinery, and the Koch brothers will get even more fabulously rich than they already are, as if $40 billion weren't enough already. They'll be more fabulously rich at the expense of our environment, at the expense of our taxpayers, and at the expense of the planet.
Well, this is unfortunate that the American public are not fully aware of this, and the media refuses to share what you just shared with us. A separate issue, however, you have certainly challenged many of your colleagues repeatedly in your support of Edward Snowden, inviting Pakistani victims of drone strikes to speak before Congress, domestic surveillance and spying, and your persistent opposition to our military engagement in Afghanistan and Iraq. And recently you were denied access to the 28 censored pages from the 9/11 Commission report that were originally supposed to have been made public but continue to be classified, although other members of the Congress, I presume, have had access to them. However, your requests have been denied. Why are these pages so sensitive? And why might the public be outraged if it were to know what the contents were?
Well, I haven't seen the report, so I can't answer that question yet. We're still in the process of trying to get that information. But public reports indicate that what that appendix demonstrates is what amounts to foreign government support for the 9/11 attackers. And specifically, reputedly, and I can't say this for a fact, I'm just going on public reports, that it documents Saudi government support for the 9/11 attackers. And that's, of course, a very sensitive subject. I hope it's not true. I'd hate to think that a government that's been an ally of ours would have turned against us in that way, or even any part of that government would have turned against us in that way. But that's sort of where we are at this point. I think that the larger point is that the spying industrial complex wants to treat America like a giant mushroom farm. They want to spread fertilizer all over us and keep us in the dark. And that's the way they've even tried to treat me, a member of Congress, duly elected by 700,000 people from Central Florida. I have a real beef with the spying industrial complex. I don't think it's necessary for the government to get a report on every single phone call that's made by every American, including this one, by the way, in order to keep us safe. I don't think that's necessary. I also think it's completely unconstitutional, and I hope that if Congress can't get its act together to point that out to the NSA and the Defense Department, then hopefully at some point the Supreme Court will. But in the name of keeping us safe, they actually keep us in fear, and that's the only way that they can maintain their own power. And this is a tremendous problem. You know, after the imbroglio over the Syrian gas attacks a year and a half ago, There was a credible report coming from the head of intelligence in Germany that indicated that our intelligence community, so our so-called intelligence community, had lied to us in order to try to get us involved in that war. And I think that given the utter failure of the intelligence community and the lies that were told to us in order to get us into a war in Iraq, we should have learned that lesson, but apparently not. So Edward Snowden comes along, reveals comprehensive, exhaustive, pervasive spying on innocent Americans like you and me, people who are no threat whatsoever to anyone else, including our government and our military, and gets vilified by the head of the House Intelligence Committee, Mike Rogers, and by many others, and threatened with prosecution simply for blowing the whistle on an obviously unconstitutional, pervasive violation of our rights. I'm appalled to see how many members of Congress come to the defense of the spying industrial complex when the spying industrial complex is acting in a completely unconstitutional fashion and in a way that treats us, we human beings who happen to be Americans, like sheep, like cattle. And I'm not a farm animal, and I don't think you are either. We deserve our freedom. We deserve to live in privacy and in dignity. And modern technology in the hands of the spying industrial complex is stealing that from us, and it's getting worse and worse every day.
My final question, which is in two parts. First, why is it that if you and I commit a crime, or any other American, we will be held accountable for that action? But when we see repeatedly major corporations, either pharmaceutical corporations, energy cartels, the banking people, when they commit a crime, there seems to be a separate set of rules governing their behavior. Just one example is that when all of the banking scandals happened, it was shown repeatedly that they had broken the laws. They had lied, they manipulated people, and yet not a single person was held accountable. They just paid fines, and those fines were then allowed to be deducted from their earnings, so it was no loss to them, because immediately in the next quarter, the next half year, they showed profits again into the billions of dollars. You and I, if we laundered money, and there was just one bank alone that laundered over $700 billion over decades, for drug cartels and other groups, they paid 1% fine, and no one went to jail. No one's reputation was besmirched. Do you see what is happening in the way our legal system is impacting the average person versus with debtors' prisons now in 27 states, with our private prison system, the incarceration of a person with a small amount of marijuana for 7 years, and yet someone in a bank, a group of people who can launder money for drug cartels, they don't go to jail. They pay a fine. Their bonuses are intact. They don't have to get back any of their profit. Could you address this, please?
Sure. I mean, the short answer to your question is that to a very large degree, the law simply does not apply to large corporations. And it doesn't because the penalties involved simply mean nothing. Large corporations. I mean, nothing. Large Wall Street operations like Citibank, like JP Morgan, like Goldman Sachs, they have $1 trillion balance sheets. A $10 million fine to a $1 trillion company is a rounding error. It doesn't mean anything to them. A company like Exxon has almost $500 billion in revenue each year. Again, a $10 million fine means nothing to them. It used to be that we kept people in line, if necessary, by incarcerating them. How do you incarcerate a corporation? In extreme cases involving treason under our Constitution or first-degree murder, people can be put to death. They can be executed. How do you execute a corporation? We simply have reached a point where they escape all accountability because the legal system is not set up to deal with their scale, and also, frankly, because they have pervasive political influence. If you look back, you'll see that when George W. Bush was elected, virtually every major antitrust case that had been brought under the previous administration came to a halt. This administration has not revived those cases. These are political decisions made in a political environment that is, in essence, an oligarchy.
We appreciate all the work you're doing for us. You're only one of a small handful of truly progressive people in Congress speaking on behalf and fighting for our interests, and we thank you for your efforts.
Thanks for telling the truth and keeping the truth out there. You're doing a great job.
Representative Alan Grayson, and his website is grayson.house.gov. I'm Gary Null. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Now over to you, Therese Lead. Hi, you, Therese.
Hello, Gary. 5 years after the devastating earthquake that hit Haiti, a political earthquake that is taking its toll.
Okay. We just dealt with that yesterday or the day before, so we'll be interested in hear your take on it.
Thank you.
You, Therese Lead, right now.